Welcome to On Farm Trials with the PNW Farmers Network, where we explore the many trials that come along with cropping systems innovation in the inland Pacific Northwest. Plenty of questions get asked while farming across this region, and together, we're digging into what it's like to try to answer some of them as producers, researchers, and the many other professionals in the field that get things done. We're glad you're here. I'm your host, Carol McFarland. Today, we're with Mr. Howard Nelson and Mr. Aaron Esser on the Wilkie Research Farm outside of Davenport, Washington, and looking very much forward to talking more about their on-farm trials as a research collaboration in answering questions important to cropping systems innovation in the region. Welcome to the podcast, you two.
Hi.
Hello, Carol.
Thanks so much for joining us. Howard, would you please start by talking a little bit about your farming conditions on your place, which is not, in fact, this Wilkie Research Farm?
Yeah, so I grew up on a farm 4 miles south of Creston, and so I've never strayed far from home. And went to school at WSU, got my degree in agronomy, worked in agribusiness for a number of years. Was offered kind of my dream job at Central Washington Grain Growers, which later became Highline Grain Growers. And so I worked with alternate crops, and I got to work with a lot of great farmers and made some friendships and was able to possibly help them with some issues they were facing.
Great. Looking very much forward to hearing more about that and also your place outside of Creston. Aaron, do you want to talk a little bit about yourself, your work, and this place?
Yeah, I've been with WSU now for WSU Extension for 26 years. My primary focus has been in the Lincoln and Adams Extension region area here. I do stray outside of the region once in a while. Anything really focused on wheat production. And today we're at the WSU Wilkie Research and Extension Farm, as you mentioned. And this is a facility I've been director of now for, I don't know, 15 years, something like that. And it's been fun.
I bet most of the people listening to this podcast probably already know, because you are a bit of a local legend yourself. Thanks for all the work you do. I know how important it is to our region's cropping system.
Yeah, whenever I needed a presenter at a winter meeting, Aaron was always there.
Yes. Always fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you always get the good. I've had you at some of those. He always gets the really good feedback, too. So this is great. So we're here to talk about some collaborative on-farm trials. I understand you guys have some stuff going on.
Yeah, so I retired from Highline Grain Growers in 2020, and I decided, you know, I've never done any agronomic work on my own farm. So I'd seen some pH issues in different areas, and I thought, well, I should grid sample my fields. And so bought a four-wheeler and got a little pH stick and a soil probe, and off I went. Grid sampling my fields, and I was disappointed to find that I did have low pH issues on my farm.
You know, Howard, I hear some people golf when they retire.
No, I fish. Okay. I've had too many shoulder surgeries for golfing.
Or measure pH. That sounds like a good way to spend some time.
You just told me how much you fish, so.
I've been busy.
Yeah. And you also failed to mention that the app that you use on your phone to figure out how to grid sample on 1 acre grids. And it's probably the only field here in the PNW that's been 1 acre grid sampled.
Yeah, I'm kind of a nerd when it comes to that kind of stuff.
Well, we like those here. You're in the right
Nothing
place.
Nothing wrong with an egg nerd.
My kids are always picking on me.
So let's dive into it. Would you talk a little bit about what motivated you to do these very intensive 1 acre scale grid samples?
I kept running into these pH issues over time at different instances across the Pacific Northwest. And the first instance was we had a triticale program. And all of a sudden, I had all this production coming out of the Rockford, Washington area. And in visiting with those growers, it was one of the few crops that would still grow out there because the pHs were so low. And then I started to see other things, but it's like I wasn't connecting the dots, you know. I saw the fall planted peas that I was working with. They didn't nodulate. And my first assumption was the rhizobium was bad. Well, it wasn't the rhizobium was bad, as the soil pHs were low. And so it was affecting the nodulation on the peas. And then I just happened to plant a trial winter wheat, and I planted triticale as the border of the wheat trial. And oh my gosh, it was night and day. The triticale just looked beautiful. The wheat was sick and wasn't doing well. And so that's when I started to finally figure out that it was just straight up soil pH issues that I was seeing.
Would you briefly give me a range of when you kind of started to notice that in your professional career? Like, what was the time frame?
Oh, gosh. So I worked for Highline in Central for 21 years. So I probably started seeing the peas probably around 2006 or 7. And like I say, I wasn't smart enough to figure it out. And then the triticale plot trial was about 2016. And so I started doing some work with Columbia River Carbonates. They had a liquid lime that we tried, but it was really hard to work with. If you didn't keep using it, it would set up and you'd have calcium in all your fertilizer lines. So it kind of went to the wayside at that point because I was approaching retirement and I was trying to finish up some of the projects I had going.
I'm looking forward to hearing a bit more about the peas too. Aaron, you've got some, I understand you've been working a bit with Howard on his lime trials at his place, and also you've got some trials here on the Wilkie Farm.
Howard and I have been cooperating for years, going back to the Central Washington days. We used to have the Northern Lincoln County Field Tour, a joint tour between them and WSU. So we've always had a lot of great collaboration. We established a lime study here at the Wilkie Farm probably back in 2017. And it too was with Columbia River Carbonates, using their liquid lime. And I wished I would have talked to Howard sooner about that stuff if you don't keep it agitated and moving, because we were using a spoke wheel applicator to apply it. And each one of those fertilizer tubes plugs up, and there's like 17 small tubes on every one of those spokes on the fertilizer applicator. It wasn't fun. But we did get the trial in, and it's been interesting. And the thing that makes the liming, I think, for this region a little bit more difficult is we never see the results per se that we, you know, the textbook says we should be seeing. And I have a couple of theories of that. One of them is, you know, all these varieties that we've been planting around here are all being selected on ground that we have around here. So we may have bred in a little bit of the tolerance, and triticale may have come from a different area where it was developed. And that's why you might be seeing a bigger jump with triticale, although it too is in general a tougher crop. But our soils can't keep going in this. We gotta, you know, we can't just put our head in the sand and say it's gonna go away or it's not my problem, let the next generation figure it out. And we need to get it figured out and how we can do it and still maintain both short-term and long-term economic viability.
Well, I know one of the questions that I've talked with both of you guys about, since we've recruited both of you to be beta testers for the updated lime requirement calculator that we're going to be putting on the Small Grains website shortly, but is just that question of how much to put down. And I know I've given you a hard time at least once at a field day, Aaron, and it got me into my own sort of trouble.
I can tell you from the trial that we had, you've got to go the full rate. You can't skimp, and you can't think, oh, I can't spend this money, because you're going to spend the money and get no results. You've got to apply the recommendation that comes off of the soil test. And then the second thing that we saw was it needs to be incorporated if you want to see benefit in your lifetime. Because we have this stratified pH.
In no-till systems.
In no-till systems. Yeah. And you have to get the lime down into that 4 to 8 inch zone, because that's the holdup right there. That's the zone that the roots, when they hit that, the plant just goes into shock.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like one of the ways that you were able to measure that in your grid sampling was with a portable pH meter. Is that how you approached that?
Yeah, so I used the portable pH meter to lay out my zones. Mm-hmm. And so then once I figured the zones out, I came back and took soil tests and sent to a soil lab. Because the if you've ever used those pH sticks, they wander. Sometimes you wonder what they're doing, because it takes so long, you know, to get it to settle in on a number. And so basically what I did is I just developed the zones, and then I followed that up with actual soil tests to a soil lab. Mm-hmm.
How much difference did you see between your zones? Did you see a lot of variability across your fields?
Oh, yeah. So all my fields have exposed caliche knobs on the hills. And so all those areas were pH 7. Plus, they're not as productive as the rest of the ground. So those zones are going to get zero lime. The mid-range zone was really small. There's hardly anything in that mid-range zone. Almost everything went to the high rate. So we either had a zero or a high rate, basically.
And you said that's being delivered, like, as we speak, huh?
Yeah, last Friday they started delivering 620 tons of lime. And sometime in October, they'll get it applied. I just need to get the zones mapped out so they can get it in their computer system on the applicator, and so they can hit the rates that I'd like.
Who's applying that?
Cascade Ag.
Cascade, okay.
Mm-hmm. So when you decided how much lime to apply, what's your experience with trying to, I'm going to call you out, Aaron. What's your experience with putting down like the right rate of lime?
I mean, from my experience, I mean, my background's in economics, not soil.
I gave you the I Love Soil stickers, though, because I know you do love soil.
And I do love soil. And that's part of the thing I think farmers find frustration is with this whole process, acidic soils, and trying to find a solution for it and everything else is, you know, we need your calculator to figure out how much we have or how much we need. I mean, that has to be step one. You talked about the lab gave you numbers. She's going to tell you that those numbers aren't quite tested for our soils per se.
Well, it depends on which test it was, because we have done the research on this.
Yes, and it does depend on what test. And I don't think the lab he was using that test.
He did, because I requested him to use the modified Malic test. And I called Carol. Called her up on the phone. She sent me her master's thesis.
Hey,
I read it. It was used.
I highlighted areas of that, Carol.
Oh, man.
No,
at least three people now have read it.
Yeah. No, it was very valuable to me, but it still didn't have the calibration of the field, actual field work. And so that was what, you know, Aaron and I did. We put this trial out in 2020. Aaron came down with his equipment and he broadcast it on. And then part of the trial was disced. So it was incorporated. And the first year in winter wheat, there was no yield difference. This year, we had a 5% increase where we put the recommended rate and it was tilled.
So you saw some results.
Yeah. And 5% for me is enough. I don't want to have a 10% loss. Mm-hmm. Because as we've talked, the lime works on geologic time. Doesn't work on my time.
It's not a fertilizer input. It's not a this season thing. And that right. It's hard. I know that from an economic standpoint, that makes it even more of a challenge.
So my viewpoint, it's like I have a house and I'm not going to wait till the roof leaks before I change the roof. When it starts to rain, I want to have all my ducks in a row, and I want to not have any issues. And the other part is I want to leave this to my family and my kids. And I don't want to give them problems. I want them to enjoy the land. And, there'll be struggles, I'm sure, but I want to have it to them in the best shape. Because my one daughter's a school teacher, my other son's a lawyer. They don't know anything about soil chemistry.
So. I mean, honestly, like they're probably better for it. Like soil chemistry really is, it's fully Alice down the rabbit hole. And you're right that as fun as it was to be a graduate student, I did have to draw the line somewhere, and doing a multi-year geologic time level follow-up of ground truthing of some of that work, I did leave to someone else. So thanks for being part of that. Aaron, you've been making some facial expressions throughout this part of the conversation. Do you want to share?
I always make facial expressions. That's nothing new, Carol.
But I had to describe it for the listeners.
And Howard said it beautifully on the basis of a landowner and a farmer and stuff, and how they really want to leave the land better for the next generation. That's something the general public doesn't understand. Or anything else. I think that we're out, degrading the land and stuff and putting pollutants out there, but that's not the case at all. Howard's very passionate about what he does, much like every other grower and landowner around here. And I think that's the one thing, if I could figure out a way to tell the people, is that, we're doing a good job and we're always looking for ways to do a better job. And that's what makes my job fun, is to work with people like Howard and work with farmers and make it better. And I love working with those passionate people who want to make stuff better. So to me, it's been a joy. And it's frustrating to me from certain areas because, I put out a trial and we have the one at the Wilkie farm that you alluded to. We've put lime on it. We put some more lime on it. We've changed the pH. We have less exchangeable aluminum, but our yield results have been minimal. And this year we did see about a 4 or 5 bushel gain on our winter wheat where we put the lime on, and we'll see what happens with subsequent crops coming through that. We're hopefully going to get another trial established here on the farm and helping people like Howard, helping all these landowners figure out how we can do it and remain economically viable. I know in my study here, there's no way we've come close to a return on our investment at this point. You talked about the 5% gain. Short term, that's not a return on the investment, but you're absolutely right looking at it in a long-term investment.
I don't want to wait until I get a return on investment.
Yes.
Because it's late and the reaction time for the liming is too slow.
Yeah.
We did hit a little bit of a bump when I went to my tenant and said, hey, I want to put lime on these fields. And there was nothing in our a lease agreement that addressed lime. So we had to come to an agreement, and which we did. And so we had to actually write a liming clause into our farm lease.
And from what I understand, actually, there are, places in the country where liming is common practice and has been for a long time. That's a very normal thing to have in a lease agreement.
In the Midwest, I think from my understanding is it's a very common thing to have a liming clause in your lease arrangements. Here in the PNW, there's probably one or two now that have a liming clause in their in their lease agreements.
I still hear that that's progress. Way to pioneer that. That's cropping systems innovation.
Yeah. And that, you know, the reason I got involved in the liming in the first place, not from the trial I had here, but WSU owns a piece of ground down by Roselia. And the farmer wanted to put lime on. And he called WSU and said, we're going to put lime on. They said, sure, I guess. And they said, it's going to cost us much. And it's like, time out. And then, you know, it's not necessarily a fertilizer. You know, WSU was paying, I think, 25% of the fertilizer bill at the time or whatever it was in their standard crop share lease. And all of a sudden, they're being dropped with this bill much larger than a fertilizer. And they're like, time out. And the only way WSU agreed to work with the landowner on it, so he put on a large-scale lime study.
Mm-hmm. That's a real, it's a very real issue. And actually, you know, Aaron, I think you said it really well. And honestly, it's very, very poignantly. And it's a theme that has actually come up as many of the guests that have been on this podcast have talked about their desire and motivation toward cropping systems innovation and trying different things on the farm is this desire to keep moving forward.
Well, that's what I think. The Wilkie farm is the only rotational crop farm in the Eastern Washington area. And for growers that want any kind of information on crop rotations, Aaron's the guy. He keeps detailed expenses, you know, what it costs him for each crop. He looks at the long range chemicals that he's applying so that it doesn't mess his rotations up. It's a undervalued farm, in my opinion. And Aaron, I think you do a great job.
Thanks. My premises with the farm, from my perspective and WSU, it's easy for me to stand up in front of people and say, this is what you got to do. You got to do A, B, and C. You need to plant this variety, put on this much fertilizer, and do this. But it becomes a little bit different when it becomes your own situation. And I like to say, you know, I got to put a little bit of my, you know, your money where your mouth is at. And that's what we do on this farm, is work through those issues. And I fully understand making the decisions on crop insurance and what level of coverage to use or how to market your crop. You know, when I took over the farm, we had the worst marketing program, grain marketing program, I think, it rival any of the worst programs. I'm like, here we are talking about grain marketing programs, and this is how we market our grain? That's ridiculous. So we do have a grain marketing program for this farm that utilizes forward contract, the tools that we have available. I can't do any, I still want to put in a situation where WSU is receiving puts and calls and requesting money for something they can't see. That would be interesting. So I can't go to that level, but we do a lot of forward contracting and stuff on our grain and as well as marketing, contract marketing of specialty crops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the specialty crops is interesting, though I have heard that you have yet to grow winter peas here on the Wilkie farm, despite some input from your advisory committee.
I think my advisory committee misspoke. We have had winter peas on the farm.
Oh.
The section around the home site.
Okay. When did you put those in, Aaron?
One of your fellow podcasters, Mark Sheffield, seeded them for me 6-7 years ago.
Uh-oh. I was misinformed. I know. I apologize for that.
Gosh, I missed that too.
Yeah. I have the numbers. If you go back and look at any of the Wilkie production report, I have a write-up back in the year when we had the winter peas on the farm. And I'm not opposed to winter peas. It comes down to a lot of the numbers and also where they have to be delivered and if I have the equipment to deliver them and stuff. One of the things that I struggle with winter peas is the weed control and trying to figure out a better way to control weeds. We had a lot of mustard in our winter peas. We put the Raptor on, and then I realized Raptor just kind of like, it wasn't very effective on mustard. So we have to go back to square one there.
It just depends on the mustard species you have.
Because yeah.
It works on tansy mustard, but it doesn't work on some of the other mustard species.
And that's one of the chemistries around the farm that I like to stay away from. Raptor, which is the same as Beyond for the Clearfield system, because of plant back restrictions on a research facility, I don't like to have a lot of ground that has Beyond on it. Mm-hmm. You had the winter pea trial here on the farm.
Well, I had winter pea trials here multiple
Rebecca
years.
McGee has had winter pea trials on the farm.
No, Aaron was always great. I'd call up Aaron and say, yeah, I want to put trial. He'd say, yeah, go out here and strip such and such. And lo and behold, all his good ground was in trials out there.
You have a point, yes. I want farmers exploring different things and utilizing different things and using some form of a matrix or a decision point to make those calls on when to put peas in, when to put wheat in, when to put canola in on the spring side, when to use peas, chickpeas, canola as well, or heck, we even have Kernza on the farm. I'm not saying we should broadcast Kernza across the whole countryside, but it's interesting, and I think it's worth keeping our eyes on.
So on my farm, my wife's and my farm, south of Creston, it was basically wheat summer fallow farm for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And the downy brome was killing us. So we started growing step-till barley. And that was the savior for taking care of the downy brome. Then for whatever reason, the barley yields didn't seem as good as they were. Kind of went to spring wheat. This year, the spring wheat on that farm was 25 bushel to the acre. And so talking with the tenant, he wants to go back to a two-year rotation. And that's fine with me because we have winter canola, we have winter peas, we have other crops. So we can still control the downy brome in that rotation now where we weren't able to do that just several years ago.
So now what have you to say about winter or managing? Now, what do you recommend for managing weeds in winter peas?
Yeah, so it was basically the Raptor clethodim mix. And we've used other things prior to that, and it was just enough that it would nick the peas up that it affected the yield. That seemed to be the best combination where we were able to get the high yields and control the majority of the weeds. Mm-hmm.
How does that work with canola in rotation? Is that, I mean, especially long term as we think about managing for herbicide resistance?
Well, there's Clearfield, both spring and winter canolas.
That's when, like, I talked about it. I don't like to use Beyond on the farm. You know, Field 4 this year got Beyond on it. We've used Beyond or the Clearfield system in the past, Field 1. And that went from Clearfield wheat, and then it's scheduled to be a spring crop, spring broadleaf, and we went with Clearfield canola on top of that. So, but it's just, I can't emphasize enough having an outline of where you want to go, having a plan in place. A good plan should always be flexible, but have a plan in place. Know what you may be wanting to put in that field in 3 or 4 or 5 years out and have a map with that in mind.
You were talking about kind of the decision matrix around all these different crops. Do you want to expand on that? Especially since we've kind of been talking about pH and how that might affect some of the decision. If you have low pH, I know that makes it a lot harder to grow things like pulses. You were talking, Howard, about really noticing an effect on nodulation and the success and thriving of legumes.
Yeah, so I leave it up to my tenant to make those decisions because he feels the full effect of the economics. I don't, I get Social Security. So I get a monthly paycheck. But they do ask me for my input. And but when it comes right down to it, it's their decision.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like being on the advisory committee for the Wilkie Farm.
That's right. Yeah. Aaron's the manager. He has to pay the bills, right?
Yeah. I remind everyone that this farm doesn't receive, WSU doesn't, gives me no operating account, I guess, for the farm. So what we do, we have to figure out a way to get it paid for on our own, whether it's crop sales, grants, teamwork, gifts, donations, whatever, to get stuff done. That's what we do. So, and that's fine. I like having, to me, it's a challenge, and it's a unique challenge, but I also like the results coming out of that challenge. Mm-hmm. Of having that real world perspective.
Yeah. You were kind of speaking to that before, because, you know, you can stand up and say like, oh, you should be doing this, but you know, you've got your skin in the game too on the research and management side of things.
And so that's where I come back to the matrix. Like I'm always, it was even working with a grower from a different county, south of here. He's considering putting in some dark northern spring wheat. So he's never planted dark northern spring wheat, but he's where a lot of the farmers are trying to find something profitable to raise. And he's not uncommon in that. I quickly did up, okay, in your area, these are the top yielding dark northern spring wheat varieties. These are the top yielding spring wheat varieties. On average, this is going to require this much fertilizer. This is going to require this much fertilizer. Here's the price of fertilizer and market price. So then I put on one axis, I have the price of dark northern spring wheat. And on the other axis, I have soft white spring wheat. And then, you know, at what price level is it worth switching from soft white to dark northern spring wheat?
Now I'm going to throw a wrench in that, because I know that you were at the workshop where last winter, where we actually had got to see a different calculator that accounted for the units of calcium carbonate equivalent to offset the input of your nitrogen fertilizer. And so if you're increasing that, you're adding also more acidity, and you're taking out of any reserve capacity for that.
I work with growers, and I know a few of them who have switched away from dark northern spring wheat and go to soft white just because they don't like putting that much additional nitrogen on for dark northern spring wheat because of what it does for your soil. You know, on average, I think soil care may correct me, but on average, for every pound of nitrogen you put on the ground, you need 2 pounds of calcium calcium carbonate. Sorry, I knew you. You need two pounds of calcium carbonate to neutralize it. So if you're using dark northern spring wheat instead of putting on 50 pounds for soft white, you're putting on 70 pounds. All of a sudden, that's 40 more pounds of calcium carbonate you need.
But you have to account for the sulfur too.
Yeah, we're getting into a lot of accounting all of a sudden.
No, it's complicated.
But it's complicated. Absolutely complicated. But it's, I think I keep reminding myself it's what makes it fun.
So I went back to try to calculate kind of a timeline on the fields on my farm. Mm-hmm. So they first had ammonium fertilizer after World War II. So roughly 48 to 50 is when they started applying fertilizer. And it was low rates at the time, but you know how it is. You know, you have a good yield, well, you bump it, you can just keep bumping the rate up a little bit because you're getting good results. So, but I calculated there's only been about 40 applications of fertilizer on some of these fields. And now we're starting to see the acidification effects of 40 applications. So if you wait to put your lime on, and say you have add another 5 applications of fertilizer to that, what's your pH going to be? What effect are you going to have? And at some point, your yields are going to drop, and just farming in general is not going to be economic on these fields.
Yeah, I like your house analogy on the roof. My analogy is I like to hunt. And to me, it's like hunting out on the breaks. You got a deer kind of up on the field edge, eating in the field. You have to make a business decision. Can I make a good shot? That's an easy, I can get my side by side over to it, or it's an easy pack out. If that deer is just a few more feet before it gets to the field, down where it really drops off, and if you make a shot and don't quite get it down and it makes it all the way to the bottom, you have a heck of a pack out. You have a lot of work. So as soon as it gets over the edge, you're going to end up with a lot of work. So let's keep it from getting over that edge.
So let's say we never put lime on these fields and the yields drop. Though the tenant could say, hey, I can't farm your ground anymore. It's not economic, right? So then I've got nobody to farm the ground. I'm 70 years old. I'm not going to farm it. So I have to keep this land in good condition or I won't have somebody to farm it.
I also saw a talk in the last couple of years. They had a speaker come in from Australia, one of the winter things. And they've got a lot of pH issues in Australia. A lot of you might have seen some of the citations from my graduate work that came out of Australia. But so they deal with stratified acidity over there. Their stratified acidity in no-till systems, it actually looks a little different because here we deep band, there they surface apply. So actually, as it turns out, if you put nitrogen at the surface, you can just put your lime on the surface and kind of that takes care of it a little bit differently than when you put it down a little deeper and you have to kind of figure out how to get down there with the amelioration amendment. But in any case, the speaker from Australia was describing their cropping system, and they were rotating wheat and canola, and that was what the market was providing. And it was, they actually didn't really have to deal with their acidity because the wheat and canola was doing just fine for the time being on the pHs as they were. But the market shifted, and actually lentils became like a really desirable price premium. And so then a bunch of guys tried to put in lentils. And they wouldn't grow. And so when I think about if we do want to reap the benefits of crop rotation, you know, whatever they are, whether that's rotating herbicides and getting weed management benefits from that, or, you know, you've described, Howard, some carryover benefits after growing peas, like whatever it is that drives someone to see the benefits of crop rotation diversification, the ability to do it can actually be limited by your soil conditions. I think that's really fascinating. And I'd actually also like to hear more about some of your experience with growing peas, because, you know, when you talk about like it still relates to soil pH too, because you don't have to fertilize them.
Yeah, no, fall planted peas are a great crop, and they're just the opposite of winter canola in the fact you can seed them as deep as you want, and it can rain on top and they still come out of the ground. So in some of these really dry zones, the fall planted peas really fit deep seeding. And the issue we had when we first started with them is we had such a range of maturities and plant types and whatever it took a number of years to find a variety. And then winter hardiness was the next issue that they cropped up. And so over time, we've been able to come up with varieties that grow well, yield well, and are relatively easy to harvest. They're a stand-up type pea. And we started growing the peas down in the Ritzville area, and Derek Schaefer was one of the early growers down there with Rob DeWald, and we just had fantastic yields. It was like that's fall planted pea heaven in that Ritzville Sprague area down there.
That's fun. So yeah, I hear that you've done, I mean, you have this whole background of doing on-farm trials work. How do you set up, what's your favorite way to set up an applied trial on the farm to get meaningful results?
Most of my work were variety trials. Mm-hmm. So So I would have a variety trial of peas. And then each year I would do some kind of agronomic study right next to it. Because I didn't have much of a budget. And basically I was working all by myself all this time. So one year I did a seeding depth study, and one year I did a rate and date study. And so it was always in association with the variety trial I had. And so over time, I was able to kind of build up the best agronomic practices for fall planted peas, but it took a while.
Would you like to share some of those pro tips at this time?
Like I say, plant them deep. No, we planted them deep. And then when it would rain and that soil would get wet above it, all these adventitious roots would come off the hypocotyl. It was totally amazing, some of the pictures that I was able to take. And, you know, the rate and date studies were important because risk management, they had nothing in their crop insurance adjusting books for fall planted peas. And so we started a project to get those reevaluated with RMA. And so they came up with the peas, because the fall planted peas tiller, like wheat, a spring pea doesn't tiller. You just get the one plant. Fall planted peas, you'll get between 3 and 8 tillers that'll actually produce and flower.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Yeah, and you were talking about RMA and risk management and getting insurance for peas. I don't know how many letters I've written for growers on winter peas as an acceptable practice for insurance, because they often need a letter of that this is an acceptable practice. And I've used a lot of Howard's data on that as variety trial data and stuff, you know, saying that winter peas are an acceptable practice if you're planting the correct varieties, and I include the data and stuff from that.
Yeah, it's amazing how much, you know, as we try different crops in rotation, how big of a piece that really is.
Oh, it's huge. All these growers have lines of credit, and the banker likes to see crop insurance right on there.
And the landlord sometimes likes to see that security as well. The bankers and the landlords like that security, as well as the growers. That's all part of what makes it go around.
So I want to circle back a little bit more to the Lyme trial work that you guys have been doing. And because we talked a lot about the why behind it, and we started to get into the how with the grid sampling and actually getting the modified Malic buffer test and determining the rate to apply that way. But how are you setting it up? I mean, in this case, it sounds like you're going in the two different zones. When you did that first trial, you said you started in 2020.
Yeah.
How did you set that up?
Well, Aaron came down and we had the lime and we just drew it out on a piece of paper. I don't know if you remember it any different than that.
No, I don't remember it much different than that. I brought my tractor down. I bought a brand new spin spreader. And thank you to Gudrun and Columbia River Carbon. It's totally for their donation and their help with the trial as well. And even the one here on the Wilkie farm, they've been fantastic to work with.
Yeah, I've worked with them too.
Yeah, and they've been really helpful for my projects, Howard's project and stuff. So I bought a spin spreader. We put the calcium, the pelletized calcium carbonate in there. And first of all, we had to see how wide it spread it. So we figured out 60 feet would work for a plot width. And then calibration is kind of difficult. So we put out a known area, pipe hands, and ran the spin spread over the top of it and figured out how many pounds per acre we were putting on. And then we got our rate finally set. We was putting out about 2,000 pounds an acre. And that was our first treatment, was 2,000 pounds an acre. And then we did a 4,000 pounds an acre treatment. So that was just going over it, I think, twice.
Right.
Or was it, do we have to go over it twice on one and four on the other? So that's how we put the trial in. We spent a lot of time on our phones, calculators, and punching numbers and figuring out the width, and then the plots ended up being 60 feet wide by 60 feet long. And then we had blocks of that. I brought my disc out that afternoon, and I disced it and harrowed it smooth. Mm-hmm.
The thing about on-farm tests is you can make it whatever you want, as complicated or as simple. But you have to have something that you want to test. You have to have a hypothesis, and then you decide the treatments and away you go.
In my experience, you have to also decide what data is important to you and what you're going to collect along the way. So what do you monitor? And then also, what are you really collecting and looking at the end, and what you're going to compare it to?
Right. So, so I'm looking at yield, and I'm looking at soil, the pH, and the effect that has on yield, because yield's the ultimate measurement, right? You have nothing if you don't measure the yield.
Because yield, and growers do sometimes think of yield as being the ultimate, but I my degree's in economics, and economics will trump yield.
So, Aaron, what do you think I've calculated the years to pay off my investment?
I'd have to go back and look at the price of lime. I don't know what it is. And that's one of the things I want to do with this, and why I haven't done a full economic production on it, is the sources I'm using. Can we find some different sources of lime to put on the smutch? Guess, though, you're going to take five crop years to pay it off. Am I close?
Yeah. So because we're doing three fields, so there's going to be crop every year from one of these fields, basically. Yeah. So I figure it takes 6 years for me to get my investment back. And that's a lot faster than I thought. And if the price of wheat would go up, it would go down. But I get my return faster.
I think everyone wants that.
Yes.
So how are you calculating return on investment, Aaron?
I mean, it's pretty, you know, understanding what you've spent, what your return is, and looking at your return on investment. And I'm looking at the other things too. That's the ultimate from a farmer standpoint. I also pull soil samples on my plots each and every year, looking at 0 to 3, 3 to 6, 6 to 12 inches, where I'm looking at what the soil pH is doing and what the exchangeable aluminum is doing.
The KCl, extractable.
And I also send grain samples off to the lab and have a nutrient analysis, because we talk about when you get more acidic soils, you don't have the nitrogen uptake efficiency or the phosphorus uptake efficiency. Am I going to see any of that in my grain samples, or is my grain going to have the same amount of nutrients in it? So I'm looking at that as well. This next year on the study, I'm also going to pull soil compaction data across the study, because they say where you've been applying lime and the calcium carbonate, you should see less compaction. Mm-hmm. So I want to look at that as well.
Yeah, calcium aggregates
the soil. Yeah. And I want to see if I can pick that up on my meter.
Your calcium's up here, but your compaction's down here. So you have to get that calcium down there.
I don't need to get it down where my compaction's at. I want it where the pH is at, first and foremost. But I also want to use that as a tool to see. I will be able to use my compaction meter. It gives me a reading every inch down to 18 inches. So I will see if somewhere in that range, if there's a difference where I've been applying the calcium or where I haven't. I've been putting my calcium down I used the spoke wheel applicator the last couple of times. The first time I used a boom buster nozzle and blew the liquid on the surface, and then the neighbor came in and did a light disking.
Yeah.
Since then, we went to the spoke wheel, which I say puts it down about 3 inches down. It puts it everywhere from 0 to 3 inches down, because it kind of spins around and it doesn't put a nice band going at 3 inches. It really moves it throughout that zone.
So we know calcium will move in the soil because we have these calcium layers, right?
Yeah.
That are down 18 to 24 inches typically.
Some places are even a lot closer.
Well, in erosion, you know, yeah, they're right at the surface. But the only soluble form of calcium is calcium bicarbonate, and it takes a living plant to calcium bicarbonate to form. So there should be some kind of a look at cover cropping, I think, in trying to get the calcium into those zones that we need them in.
And your point is exactly one of the reasons I haven't gone, I guess, gung-ho on liming the whole farm is trying to find some alternatives to liming. And that's one of the things I'm interested in from our, for no better terms, our cow chow study we have on the Wilkie farm.
Cow chow.
I know. Or our other cover cropping system here. And a piece I always say about liming as well, and it comes from some of my experience with the trial we have, is I'm not sure any of us can answer correctly what we have to do to correct the situation. But the one thing I want each and every one of the farmers I talk to do is understand what got you in that situation. And it doesn't do you much good to, you know, like you're talking about the roof, you know, take all the old layers off and do the roof right. Don't just put a roof on top of a roof. I mean, you haven't really fixed it. You're covering it up.
Right.
And that's, you got to take care of what got you that problem. And about the same time we put the lime study in, we also put, we went to variable rate fertilizer. And instead of one zone for these fields, we soil sample three zones. Our red zone, our lowest yielding zone, which is about 22% of every field. We soil sample our high yielding zone, about 22% of every field. And we fertilize and manage each of those three zones differently. The one thing I've noticed in my trial that has me scratching my head is we've seen the pH come up where we put the calcium carbonate. I've also seen the pH come up a touch where we haven't put the calcium carbonate. And the only thing I can think of is I'm doing a better job of fertilizing there and not leaching as much or putting on excess fertilizer.
A lot of questions.
I wish it was easy. Once in a while, where's that easy button?
No, for every answer you get two or three questions, right?
And if we knew the answers, I wouldn't have had to put in the trial. If we all knew the answers to your situation, we wouldn't have had to spend the days out there putting it in. But for any grower trying to make that type of investment, doing what Howard's done, instead of just saying, oh, someone told me to do it, the neighbor told me to do it, or I can't make money, sit down on your situation and figure it out. There's a lot of people who are willing to help.
Well, the thing is, there's areas in every field, like an approach, that for years had excess fertilizer applied, and they don't grow much anymore. So I think a good way for a grower to experience this would just get a little bit, put it on those spots or down the borders where they've had excess nitrogen applied for years, and just see if you can see a visual difference.
When you say a little bit, I don't think you mean just
A little bit.
You have to put a little bit at the right amount to a small area, right?
Right. So when I say a little bit, I'm not referring to the rate per acre.
Yes.
I'm referring to the quantity applied. So take a soil test, put out the recommended rate. As you told me one time, this is not new. Liming is not new. It's been around a long time. We're just starting to see it here, is all.
Well, and actually, from a research standpoint, I'm sure you run into this too, Aaron. I know in the work that I've done, and thanks to the Washington Grain Commission, because they're the ones that funded the research I did, but it's very difficult to get funding for liming because so many other places already have well-developed liming programs. And so, you know, our region here, experiencing this, and yes, we have mollic soils, not necessarily naturally acidified soils, but I don't know. Like I said, I don't know if you've tried to get funding for this, but it's a regional problem. And so I think regional dollars really help to answer some of these outstanding questions we have for our area, but to go for, you know, a lot of the university funding comes from federal sources, and it's just not a really easy sell because there's so many other places that are like, this isn't even a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why I want to parrot what Aaron said is Columbia River Carbonates has been right there trying to get trials out, providing material, paying for soil tests. I mean, Gudrun Mart has really been an advocate to correct these soil pHs.
Well, and they really, you know, they've really, in my experience, been working to try to make a product that will do that more ag time, not geologic time, because the particle size can go a long way toward reactivity. But I think ultimately also the quantity needs to be there. Like, you can get a really great product. The research I've seen suggests is that you still need to figure out how to get the right quantity at the right rate.
Right.
If you want to actually see your pH moving. But I also know, you know, you were talking, Aaron, about your spoke wheel injector.
Yeah.
I know the Cook Agronomy Farm and the researchers with the Northwest Sustainable Agroecosystem Research Unit with the USDA, ARS, they've got an undercutter.
Yeah, the injector,
And it's been modified to
put lime down or across the sweep.
Oh, okay.
So you can, I mean, you can truly set it down for 4 inches, 3 inches, and lay a row of lime down where it's needed on your
yeah
0 to 3, 3 to 6, 6 to 12 inch, where you need the lime.
Dr. Joaquin Casanova is the scientist who's been leading that. Charged with a lot of support just in terms of the equipment side of things from the other support.
Yeah, because to get like a 2-ton rate of, say, sugar lime, that's a lot of gallons of liquid to get.
But also the sugar lime is only like 68% calcium carbonate. So we have to remember.
No, it's 80.
It's 80?
Yeah.
Okay. I've seen different tests, I guess. So that's good that
that's the last one that I was provided.
That's great. I'm glad you have that number because that's a very important number because it's when we get our, if we're doing it, the liming program proper way is when we get our rate from the soil test lab. We have to make sure that's, we're calculating into pounds of calcium carbonate and then adjusting for it only actually the product having 80%. Of that in it. So it's, you did your homework and that's all built into the new calculator too.
And
so,
even with our spoke wheel applicator to get the rates we've been putting on, we have to run it over that same piece of ground 3 times.
Yeah.
We can put out about 33 gallons at the speed we're traveling. So putting on 100 gallons at a time and back, forth, back, forth. And one of the tools I look forward to using that we got on the farm a little too late this spring is the Varis machine. Mm-hmm. And the thing I'm most excited about that is you were talking about you have the map of the pH map of your farm. I don't have that for this whole farm. I can come very close. I know each zone or I know each field. I have a long history of pulling soil samples at 0 to 3, 3 to 6, 6 to 12 inches, and knowing what my extractable aluminum is, what my pH is, but I don't have it for every for across the field, and that's the next step I want to get to.
Now, are you familiar with some of Tabitha Brown's work where she ran that around Cook Farm, that one of the Varis probes?
A little bit.
Yeah. I think she had, you know, you don't want to poke that into super dry soil and maybe there's
that's
cold
why I
temperature.
Said we got it too late and didn't have it figured out, and spring went too fast, and then now we have to wait
farming
for the spring. Yes. It's just, we talked about finances and stuff being short, but in my experience, time is the most limiting factor. Always has been.
Yeah. Do you calculate in that on your ROI on a practice?
No, it would never make sense. Both financially or common.
I wanted to briefly touch on, so you have an advisory committee. We kind of joked a little bit about your advisory committee for the research that you do here on the Wilkie Farm. And Howard, you've been a part of that committee for a long time.
Yeah. I don't know, 10, 15 years, maybe.
Something like that, yeah. No. I don't know how long I've been on the committee. I made up my number earlier in my introduction.
No, it's always
it kind feels of like a, forever.
It's always kind of a fun meeting because Aaron and I can spar back and forth a little bit.
And I mean, that's, I always like, even giving a presentation, nothing's better than giving a presentation with an audience who asks a lot of questions. And you know, wants to know more about the whys and hows and things like that, because that's really where the learning takes place from both participants. Mm-hmm. And I've always enjoyed that with Howard, going back and forth on various things and stuff. We were talking about the winter peas, but chickpeas, and we've had chickpeas on the farm. And the one crop I had a significant return on field four, where we have the Lyme study, we had chickpeas on the ground, and we saw a significantly increase in yield with chickpeas on that piece of ground where we have the Lyme study. So, and he's the one that made it, you know, I put the matrix together for Howard. And yes, we get a better wheat yield off of it, but my spring wheat yield suffers following, if you go chickpeas, winter wheat, spring wheat, that spring wheat yield will be a bushel or two less than if you go canola, lower winter wheat, and then you'll have a little bit greater spring wheat because the winter wheat took more out of the ground where you had the chickpeas. It's fascinating to watch.
Well, that's why Aaron's rotations are important, because it's a system. Everybody tends to look at this crop, but you have to look at the whole system over time, because one crop affects the next and right down the line. So,
and then you got the details, what you want to do, and then what happens. I mean, like this year, the north side was going to be chickpeas. We lined it up to get chickpeas. Okay, everything was going. I called and say, where do I come pick up the chickpea seed? We don't have any. We overcommitted. Or something. I think that was the answer they told me. So all of a sudden, where I thought I had pea seed, all of a sudden I didn't have pea seed. So then I had to quickly go, plan B, plan B, plan B. and stuff, and shuffled things around, because what you want to do in farming and what you can do can sometimes be, I don't think my experience was different from what farmers see on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. So,
Howard, you mentioned the kind of effects on the system, and I wanted to circle back again because I know how much we love winter peas.
Yeah.
And what sort of effects, like carryover effects, have you seen year to year when in your experience with winter peas?
Yeah. So I've been fortunate. I had winter peas in one field. There was 80 acres on the one end, and there was 240 acres of wheat on the other side. And there was a perfect line between these two. So I decided I was going to do a fertilizer rate and variety study. And I was going to do both the winter and the spring. So the first year I did spring wheat with different fertilizer rates. And there was a 30% increase in spring grains following fall planted peas versus winter wheat. So then I had an identical size plot saved for the fall. I put winter wheat and fertilizer rate with six different winter wheat varieties. And there was no yield increase. And so when I charted out the yields with the fertilizer rates, I finally determined that we'd already hit the top yield with a zero fertilizer rate, and we were coming down the backside of the production curve because we'd over-fertilized on the backside. So to me, you really have to be careful of your fertilizer rates following winter fall planted peas, or you're going to wipe out the benefit that you had from the crop rotation by over-fertilization. So there was way more mineralization than I had determined prior to that study.
Thanks for sharing that.
Let's see if the soil sample.
That's right.
And dang
not,
it.
Not just 1 foot.
Yeah. Yes.
So I had a guy helping me. I told him I wanted 6 foot soil samples. And he literally destroyed my soil probe to get that 5th and 6th foot. Mm-hmm. It was just hard. But that's where a significant amount of fertilizer was at.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know, should we plug your nitrogen use efficiency calculator, Aaron?
That's one of the things I've always talked about with the whole soil pH thing is, you know, step one is, what are you doing to improve your nitrogen use efficiency? I said a long time ago, it doesn't do you any good to fix your problem if you're going to use the same methods that got you in the problem in the first place. So I don't know how to fix the problem necessarily, and we're doing a lot of learning. We've come a long ways in the last 5 years, 6 years on it. But I'm not sure we all truly have the answer for the area. But I do know we need to do a better job of just improving our nitrogen use efficiency. And there are tools available for that on the Small Grains website.
Mm-hmm. WSU Wheat and Small Grains.
Well, yeah. you need to know your grain proteins. And so all you got to do is have a few bags, put some wheat in there, and you get done with harvest. You go into the local elevator, and they'll say, fine, here's the grain, here's the protein machine. You know, this is how it works. And you can calculate a lot of that out yourself pretty simply.
Yeah.
I mean, or you can get really fancy and you can run a protein monitor on your combine, like some people here on this farm.
Yeah. All it takes is time and money.
Time, right?
That doubles the value of the old 9500 over there. But it does take time then to process the data. Mm-hmm. It's a combination of time and money. Mm-hmm. Always has been, always will be.
Well, the hard part is always sorting through the data you have, trying to make sense of it, because there is so much data you can collect at this point.
And that's why the nitrogen uptake use efficiency calculator stuff, you need to know your yield, how much soil nitrogen you have, how much you applied, and your protein. You only need 4 pieces of information. It doesn't take a lot of work, time, or money to get those 4 pieces of information.
Well, and hopefully that is time that will save you money.
And that should be time well spent and should help with the profitability side of things as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, seriously, Aaron, I think are you still running a protein monitor on your combine here?
Yeah.
Okay, and you're pairing that with your yield monitor data to kind of do some of that on the fly?
Yeah. We bring that information in. When I talked about our prescription maps, we bring that in. And I use it. The one thing I use the protein monitor for, it's almost like my grade sheet. I mean, my dream is to be able to take my field, harvest it, and say, I want my protein between 9.5 and 10. Maybe 10.3. If I can get a whole field in that range, that's what I want to get. That's my goal. Maximized yield, you know, 10.5 is kind of maximum yield. The Grain Commission doesn't like that. So 9.5 to like 10.3, 10.5, no more. Actually, probably 9.5 to 10.5. If I can get a whole field, 9.5 to 10.5 is my fertilizer program's doing pretty good.
So now, speaking of the ARS scientists with the Northwest Sustainable Agroecosystem Research Unit, I mentioned Dr. Casanova and the lime sweep study, but he also has a nitrogen optimization by wheat class tool. He gave a soil health coffee hour with the Farmers Network, and it's available on the YouTube channel as well. That might be something you'd be interested in checking out. Yeah, so getting the nitrogen right, whether you're getting some benefit from the peas, making sure that you're optimizing pH and calculating our nitrogen use efficiency. It's a system. It all plays together. Let's see. I don't think we looked at any of these questions at all during this conversation today?
I studied for all of them.
We've been talking the whole time.
So I'd be interested just to hear a little bit from each of you of some of the benefits that you've seen in terms of working together for your on-farm trial work. You know, whether it's you, Howard, as an advisory board member, it sounds like some of that came up already for the Wilkie Farm research, or being able to call up Aaron and say, hey, help me do this trial.
Aaron was always a good resource and always open to basically letting me plant whatever I needed on the farm. That was my data. So it wasn't something I gave to Aaron until later in the fall, after I was able to go through it. But Aaron was always looking for ways to help farmers. And whether it's the cropping rotation or the different chemical rotations and stuff. And that's a resource that nobody else is looking at. So anyway.
Yeah, and I mentioned earlier, I've been with Extension for 26 years. And one thing some of the older Extension agents pounded into my mind is, you know, when you think about Extension, you think I'm working with farmers and stuff on a daily basis. Some of the ways I can have my biggest impact with farmers is working with the people that the farmers work with, their fieldmen. And that's always been a very important part of my job, is to work with the crop consultants and stuff around the area. And Howard's always been one of the great ones to work with. So it always makes it fun. I like the challenge of it. And I've always enjoyed, I know where his heart's at with the farm and going back to that. So that's what's always made it fun for me. His heart's in the same place my heart's at.
Mm-hmm. In the dirt.
In the dirt.
In the soil.
In the soil. Some of it's still dirt. Some of it's still, but he's never been corporate ladder guy. And I've always enjoyed that in our working relationship that we've had.
So Aaron, when was it you took over management of the Wilkie Farm?
16 years ago, yeah. 17.
And so I was around before Aaron was here. And Aaron has turned this around and really done a stellar job to make it applicable to what farmers need to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was probably before you were on the Wilkie Farm Committee. I made a statement. The only thing we're doing with this farm right now is showing farmers how not to farm.
Yeah,
we have the weediest summer fallow in the county. Or we can't even seed our wheat because we have to mow it. You know, we had issues and stuff. And, you know, every once in a while you can hear the traffic driving by, right? That's Highway 2. A lot of people see this facility driving by, and, you know, I wanted to showcase what we can do with these crops, cropping systems, crop rotations, and for no better term, it's just good farm management.
The only problem the Wilkie Farm has, it's too small. It needs to have more acres. So
you should see the face Aaron's making right now.
Well, there are more rotations that can be studied, and maybe cover crops, things like that. And so, you know, as part of the advisory committee, we actually approached a neighbor and received a resounding no as far as, you know, interest in working with us. So if there's anybody listening that's willing to help Aaron, just let us know.
Yeah.
What kind of help is Aaron looking for? I mean, is this like growing really weird stuff? Like
no,
alternative crops? More cows?
He's pretty limited. You know, he does a 3-year, a 4-year, and a continuous crop rotation. It'd be nice to try some different crops within those systems, maybe.
Like what? What would you like to see?
Fall planted peas.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Triticale. I love triticale.
We just got to hear from Bill Schillinger and a whole crew of other great on farm trial cooperators with Ron Jaray on his place.
Yeah.
And it sounds really like one of Bill Schillinger's favorite takeaways from his long career at the Lynn Field Station is that he likes triticale pretty well.
Yeah.
Everyone is raised triticale likes it. Mm-hmm. I just wish we had a chicken farm closer to us.
Do we?
There
know?
You go.
No, there we don't go. It's one of those crops that frustrates me because of the marketability of it. And trying to find a good, consistent market is... Oh.
Yeah.
And the peas, I can't wait for the winter peas to all become edible. Instead of, a lot of your old marketing pools, they were going into cover crop seed and dog food, right?
Yeah, actually, so, 1 year we killed it with cover crop seed. And that was a good year.
It was a good year.
Yeah.
But, you're trying to come up with that good, consistent market. And when I look at what people are consuming, those proteins are coming back pretty strong. And I can't wait to get the winter peas that are more for human consumption. And I think that will add a lot. Except then everyone will be raising them and that will crash the price. The best cure for high prices is high prices.
Not everyone will be rotating responsibly.
That's what John Newkirk always used to say to me, the economist. The best cure for high prices is high prices.
Yeah.
Is that the words of wisdom you want to leave with, though, Aaron?
That sounds good to me. Would you rather be, I love soil?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
That's why we're all here.
I love profitable soil.
Yes.
I love profitable cropping systems.
I guess... Just to wrap up, I would like to offer each of you the chance to share any final thoughts on any of the plethora of topics that we have discussed today in the partnership as we seek meaningful results from on-farm trials and cropping systems innovation and soil health. And
I think soil pH is a ticking time bomb. It's going to happen. You can say, I want to see the return on investment. You can say all these things. And don't wait too long is going to be my piece of advice. Don't wait until you have a severe problem because you're not going to fix it overnight. It's going to take time for the calcium to react and for you to see the results.
Carbonate to react.
Okay. Yeah.
The calcium will stick around and do all the other cool stuff.
It's easier to get those to react if you have actively growing roots on the ground.
That's right.
If you can't get actively growing roots to help it react, it makes it
we think
a lot more difficult.
We look back to what was here before we were here, right? It was grassland. There was an actively growing crop every year. And maybe there was lupins with grass or sagebrush or different forbs, but it was a mixture of things. And, I'm not saying that we can go back to that, but I think we need to look at that and see what we can learn.
Never stop looking, never stop learning.
Well, I really appreciate both of you. It's such an honor to interview folks like you and have you all give me some of your time sharing your wisdom and experience and lessons learned in this space. So really appreciate you taking some time today to be on the On Farm Trials podcast. Thank you very much for all you've shared.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
As always, a big thank you to our guests today for sharing their wealth of knowledge and experience with us. This podcast is produced by the PNW Farmers Network team with music credit to Carlos Flores. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers alone and do not represent that of the PNW Farmers Network or any associated agencies. Please remember that experimental results will vary, and listeners are encouraged to try things at home. If you like what you heard, please support this work by sharing, rating, and reviewing. And do consider joining us as a guest or nominating a friend who is trying things on their farm. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, happy trials.